So I'm going to talk a little bit about the science and a little bit about the public health approach. I have nothing to declare, but I would like to say thank the Joyce Foundation, which has been the most important foundation in this whole area in terms of funding gun research. I'm going to do a very, very quick summary of the literature, and here it is. We have an enormous gun problem in the United States, and it's really due to because we have so many guns, particularly handguns, and we have by far the most permissive gun laws. More guns means more death because there's more gun death. And in the literature, there are case control studies that show this, there are ecological studies that show this, there are evaluations, literature reviews. We're doing expert surveys every month of gun researchers in this area and asking them what they think about this, what the science shows. If you have a question you want asked on these surveys, send me an email. As mentioned, we have this enormous problem in the United States. Over 300 people are shot, and then we have all these criminal gun uses and intimidations. More Americans have been killed, more civilians have been killed from guns since I graduated from college than were killed on all the battlefields and all the wars by any for any reason in all American history. World War I, World War II, the Civil War, it's just incredible. And gun violence is a highly American problem. It's a unique American problem, especially when you compare us to all the other high-income countries. We have a paper coming out soon which looks at the United States versus the other 24 industrialized democracies. This just gives you a feeling about children aged 5 to 14. You could look at women, you could look at the elderly. What does this show? So here we're looking at children K through 8. Basically, this is elementary school and middle school, and what it says is that a child in the United States has a higher likelihood of being murdered with a gun than children in Norway or Canada or Germany or Japan or Italy. And it's not that it's 50% higher or twice as high or four times as high. It's 18 times higher. And our gun suicide rate for these children is 11 times higher. Our unintentional firearm death rate is 12 times higher. I teach at a school of public health where a lot of international students, and they just cannot understand what we are doing, why we refuse to protect our young and our children and our elderly. I've been spending a lot of time trying to promote the public health approach to gun violence prevention, as a lot of other people have. And what I want to say, one thing is that the public health approach is in, which is wonderful. I looked on Google, and people want to use the public health approach for bereavement, for cybersecurity, for gambling, for malware propagation, for obesity, for fracking. I have no idea what they mean by it. I don't think they know what they mean, but it's really great that everybody wants to use this approach. Here's what CDC says the public health approach is, define the problem and so forth. I never quite understood this because it looks to me like this is the scientific approach. What is this? So here's what I think the public health approach is. Here's and what I want to talk about. If you ask me in one sentence what the public health approach is, it's make it easy for people to stay healthy and make it difficult to get sick or injured. And if you do that, you're going to do well. If you want people not to be obese, make it easy to eat good food, make it really easy to exercise. If you want them to be obese, make it really easy to eat crummy food and really easy to sit around. If you asked me if I had more than one sentence, I would say here are five key elements to the public health approach. The first one, I would argue, is prevention, and people always talk about this, and it's the more upstream as possible. Curative medicine and criminal justice talk about prevention, but 95% of their work is after the fact. Our work is before the fact, trying to prevent things from happening in the first place. Secondly, the public health approach is about populations rather than named individuals. When I give talks to psychiatrists about suicide, I will ask, why do you think there's so many more suicides in Arizona than in Massachusetts? And the right answer they give is, gee, that's interesting, we didn't know that. Nor should they know that, because that's not their interest. Their interest is why Mary feels so depressed and how to get Mary to feel better. And if I push them a little further and ask, why do you think it's true, it's so much higher, suicide is so much higher in Arizona than in Massachusetts, why do you think? And they'll come up with these ideas that, you know, maybe it's the immigrants, maybe it's the sun, maybe there are more psychiatrists there, whatever. But when you do the real studies, which we have done and other people have done, what you find is that to try to explain differences in suicide across cities, across states, across regions in the United States, it is not explained by mental health. It is not explained by suicide ideation. It is not explained by suicide attempts. What is it explained by? Guns. The public health approach is a systems approach, trying to create good systems, so again, that makes it easy for people to behave well, and we'll talk about that. Public health approach is broad and inclusive. You're trying to get everybody to help. My idea of the public health approach is you step back and you say, how can every, you know, say we really want to make this a societal problem that we want it to go away. Who could do what? And the answer is a lot of people could do lots of things if this is what our society wanted. Not only gun manufacturers and gun dealers, but clergy could do more, foundations could do more, hairdressers could do more, and lots of people if we all got together, which other countries have done sometimes, and we could make a great, great difference. And finally, public health is not about blaming. Too often you find in the United States people love to blame, and the problem with blaming is basically you're saying it's not my problem, it's their problem, they're at fault, I don't have to do anything. And that means basically nothing gets done. And instead of blame, the pro-gunners always say, you're trying to blame the gun. And they say, no, you're not trying to blame anything, you're just trying to figure out how to reduce the problem. And it's really about shared responsibility. One of the things everybody in the injury prevention world learns about is the motor vehicle success story, and I'll do this very quick. This is what we in the injury prevention world sit around the campfire and tell to our young, the new postdocs. This is the story, and it's a just so story. It's about 90% right. It's not 100% right, but it's close enough. And it's one of the great accomplishments of the 20th century in terms of public health. The story goes like this. When I was growing up, we were told, and there is data to show it, so it must be true that the large majority of motor vehicle crashes were due to driver error. If drivers never made errors, there wouldn't have been these crashes. You had tired drivers, distracted drivers, angry drivers, you name it. What's the policy if it's all the driver's fault? Educate and train drivers. I went to high school in Illinois, and in my cohort, every person, if you wanted to graduate from high school, had to take driver's ed. What do we learn now from driver's ed is that it doesn't seem to affect fatalities, except that it lets kids drive younger and die sooner. But motor vehicle deaths, we learned, and the data prove it, most motor vehicle deaths, the majority, are associated with clear and deliberate unlawful behavior by motorists. There's speeding, there's drunk driving, there's running red lights. If we could only get people to obey the law, we could eliminate more than half of motor vehicle deaths. So what should we do? We ought to enforce the traffic laws. Interestingly, education and enforcement. That's the mantra of the gun lobby today. Educate everybody, enforce the traffic laws. It wasn't, though, until the late 1950s that public health physicians asked a different question, not who caused the crash, but what caused the injury. It is pretty clear a lot of people were being killed when their chests were struck by steering columns, which didn't collapse. Their faces were being lacerated by windshields, which were not made of safety glass. They were thrown from the car. Their heads would hit the cement. They would die. Sometimes they would leave the road for 1 second, and they would hit lampposts and trees which were planted along the sides of roads. Fortunately, we're not putting lampposts along the sides of major runways in airports, but we were putting them along the sides of major roads, and we said, can't we do something? Can't we make the car better? Can't we make the roads better? Can't we make the EMS system better? And the punchline is, 60 years later, nobody thinks drivers today are better than they were in the 1950s. You ask any expert, they will tell you we're a little better about drunk driving, we're a lot worse about distracted driving and cell phone use and so forth. But fatalities per mile driven have fallen over 85%. So that means of the 20 people who would have been killed when I was young, only 3 people are dying today. An incredible success story. We can do a lot better. It's not like we're we finished in the motor vehicle era, but we've done a lot better. And we're using this same approach finally in the last 15, 20 years about physician error. Instead of saying, oh, you made an error. Who is that bad physician? Who is that bad nurse? Take their license away. We're saying, let's create a system where it's really hard for these physicians to make errors, where it's really hard for these nurses to make errors. And then when they start making errors, let's make it so bells and whistles ring and you stop making the error. And that's the key insight, is that it's often the most difficult thing to change people. It is much, much, much easier to change the system, and you want to create a system where it's really hard to make mistakes, really hard to behave inappropriately, and then still some people will, and then you want to make sure that nobody is seriously injured. So we have, over time, done better and better about learning to live with motor vehicles, trucks, and so forth. We haven't done a good job learning to live with firearms. It looks like we're going to have firearms for a long time to come. We have the new interpretation of the Second Amendment. And if we're going to have lots of firearms, let's figure out how not to die with them. And one of the things, again, the lessons from motor vehicles is that there's lots of motor vehicle problems. There's problems about pedestrians, about motorcycles, there's problems about bicyclists, there's problems with rear-end collisions, with rollovers, with head-on collisions, and so forth, and no one policy solves everything. I worked for Ralph Nader for a long time, and we pushed and pushed and pushed for airbags. This is going to make a big difference, and it took 20 years of pushing, and finally something good happened. We have airbags, and they're wonderful, but they don't help pedestrians, and they don't help bicyclists, and they only reduce motor vehicle fatalities by 11% only, but that's huge. That's more than 3,000 people a year. But it doesn't solve all the problems. In the same way, in the firearms area, we have gun accidents and gun suicides and gun assaults. We have intimidations by guns. We have gangs. We have, we have mass shootings. We have you name it. And there's no one policy that's going to change everything. But if everybody does something, if we force, or if the manufacturers on their own change their firearms, we could do a lot. If the distribution system was changed, a lot could be accomplished. If social norms could be changed. Here's one just simple example about one thing manufacturers could do. Right now, I've been doing studies about unintentional firearm fatalities, and there are a lot more than are listed in Whiskers, in the vital statistics. And one of the common reasons for an unintentional firearm fatality is a teenager finds his dad's semi-automatic pistol, he takes out the magazine, here's all the bullets, here's the gun, and he pulls the trigger. And usually nothing bad happens, but sometimes he kills his best friend. Most medical examiners call that a homicide because he pulled the trigger intentionally, but it was a complete accident. We can blame the kid. We can blame his parents. We can blame, or you can solve the problem, make it so when you have a semi-automatic pistol and you take out the magazine, the gun won't shoot. It's so easy. And that's all we have to do. There's a lot of social norms that need to be changed. Right now, we just did a national survey, and we estimate that 300,000 to 500,000 guns a year are stolen in the United States. Why are they stolen? Because people don't lock up their guns as well as they should, and there's no liability when the guns get stolen. One of the things I want to see changed is selling guns to a stranger without a background check. I want to make that illegal, but also I want to make it immoral. How can we live in a society where someone who thinks they're a good Christian or whatever can sell a gun to a stranger without a background check? What do they think is going to happen? I mean, I was raised on Westerns in the 1950s. This is like selling, rifles to the Indians. What are we doing? One of the things that we're doing in Boston is trying to reduce straw purchasers. We know that most men buy guns and most men are straw purchasers, but when a woman buys a gun, she is much more likely to be a straw purchaser than when a man buys a gun. She often buys a gun for her boyfriend. Women don't quite understand that this is a felony. You can go to jail for 20 years and it's wrecking your own community. And we're having this trainings and getting everybody together, and this is selling really well. People are really buying into this, and they're really buying into the notion that if your boyfriend asks you to buy a gun for them, get rid of that boyfriend. No good boyfriend should ever ask his girlfriend to do this. One of the areas we found in terms of there's common ground with the gunners, and one of the areas is suicide. We're working with gun shops to try to reduce suicide. We're working with gun trainers for the first time ever. A few gun trainers are including suicide prevention in their gun training. For every gun accidental gun death, there are about 30 gun suicides. Of course you have to include it. And all these gun trainers are saying, we never really thought of that. Of course we should be doing that. And some of them are starting to do it. Again, like a lot of people in public health, I'm very optimistic because there have been so many incredible successes in public health. A few years ago, I wrote this book, Success Stories in Injury and Violence Prevention. This is 64 documented successes where the world's been made safer just in the area of injury and violence, and 36 heroes you've never heard of who have pushed and pushed and pushed to make this happen. And every one of these successes faced strong resistance. It's just incredible in public health. It's hard to find a success which didn't face a strong resistance. You can't believe, how could there be strong resistance against sanitation? Don't we want to get rid of the poop? You want to leave it here? I mean, what are we doing? But you said to fight and fight and fight and fight for it. And that's what we need to do in this area. Do we have a current tipping point? I hope so. What I've been noticing is that reporters are, usually I get to talk to reporters after major shootings, and then 2 days later they stop calling, but they keep calling now, which is really wonderful. Finally, after 20 years, the Democrats have awakened again to the interests of gun safety. You have great new troops, groups forming, but unfortunately still, from the point of view of research, and I'll tell you, every one of these success stories, research and data mattered. They really matter. And right now, we still have incredibly little money for research. Thank you.